Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. I am your host and creator, Jason Herbert. And every single week, we are bringing you movies and the history behind them. And this week, we are talking about 2005's Munich, directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Eric Bana, Daniel Craig, and a whole bunch of other really talented folks. And I think it'd be impossible to talk about this movie without referencing what's going on in the Middle East right now. And in fact, that's the reason why we're having this discussion, because film can be a really powerful medium for talking about the past, but also talking about the present. That's exactly what we're doing in this podcast today. I invited on a couple returning favorites, Jeff Melnick, who you know from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and our great friend Eric Baker, who is a lecturer of the history of science at Harvard University. And we have a really great deep discussion on this film, the events that happened in 1972, why they are relevant in 2005 when Spielberg is making this film alongside other films, and like really kind of Spielberg's personal response to this. And then, of course, its relevance today in 2024 and beyond. So this is a deep conversation. It's a lot of fun conversation at times. It's also a very trying conversation at times. This is part of the reason why we have this podcast, is to get into these discussions that hopefully make us think and make us feel. So I hope you enjoy this conversation today. I had a really thought-provoking time. It was great to spend time with my friends, Jeff and Eric, and I hope you enjoy this. So sit back and relax, because Munich is next on the Historians of the Movies podcast. Right, Jeff Melnick, Eric Baker, welcome to Thunderdome. So,
thanks, Jason. Great to be here in the Thunderdome as always.
Well, I saw you, Eric, in Denver most recently in Mountain Time.
Yeah, at the world's most cursed hotel. No offense to the terrific organizers at Society for U.S. Intellectual History. Not their fault, but the hotel had some dark energy. That's all I'll say.
That was a weird place. Actually, and for me, that's a weird conference.
It's kind of like haunted doll, the energy of a haunted doll, like scaled up to a hotel.
It was weird. And I was on the rom-com floor. Jeff, so we were at the U.S. Intellectual History Conference.
Man, I'm picturing The Shining already. You're talking like Cursed Hotel.
Literally, the last night of the conference, you know, after things said, I was in my hotel room, couldn't sleep. Was looking through movies. One of the only movies they had on the hotel TV was The Shining. So I was like, oh my God, in Colorado, cursed hotel, let's do this. Watch The Shining. Yeah.
I have my thoughts on Colorado itself, but that's okay. Like, the big thing I'm adjusting to right now is the fact that I'm 2 hours behind East. The world runs on Eastern Standard Time, right?
Yeah.
And when I was living in Florida, God bless it for all of its troubles, at least I could be like, yeah, we'll do the pod whenever. It's no problem. And here I'm like, well, I live 16 hours behind you. So let's just, because it's like, it's 6 o'clock where you guys are, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, it's like 4 o'clock. I'm like, well, I guess I'll record a pod, then go get food. I don't know. It's just, it's a weird kind of time of day. A little bit, either way. So, all right, let's just jump into this thing. Let's introduce you guys, and then we'll jump into this movie, Munich, and kind of go from there. Jeff, you know, we had talked about doing Munich for a while. You'd come to me. This is a deeply personal film. We're recording this. It's January 19th, and it feels like the whole world is falling apart in the Middle East right now. I don't know a lot about Middle Eastern history. I know even less about the events of Munich aside from watching this film. But I think that's actually the perfect reason to talk about this movie, right? To really kind of dig into this. And the whole idea behind HATM is to use movies to jump into these histories. So this is, you know, this is something that, like, this particular film, I was, you know, when you came to me, I was like, all right, absolutely, let's do this movie. And then I was also like, okay, this movie, this is heavy. This is heady stuff we're doing today. So,
I think just jumping right.
Yeah.
Like one of the questions we're going to have to, I think, you know, negotiate is how much we think it's about the Middle East. You know, that's, I think.
I was about to say, you know, I'm coming here. I mean, I'm not an I'm not a, I mean, both Jeff and I are, you know, American historians by training, you know, and we're obviously invested in geopolitics. And, you know, I think I speak for both of us. We're invested in Palestinian liberation, but,
absolutely,
you know, the, for me as an American cultural historian, interested in the history of, you know, US military and anti-militarist politics, this is a really interesting document of the early years of the war on terror. And, you know, what I see is Spielberg's really kind of long 21st century attempt to think about America and its values through the lens of this conflict.
Really well put. Yep.
Yeah, you know, this movie does a lot more than just document, say, the Munich attack, the response to that attack. This is really actually, especially as the film goes on, you kind of see Spielberg working his way through this film, right? Where, and you know, Spielberg doesn't kind of famously did not do any press for this film at all. You know, just kind of put this out. And I think it was very real reason where he was just like, this isn't, in some ways, this movie is not entertainment,
right?
For Spielberg. This was,
and the other thing, the weird, you know, something, again, I'm not sure, you know, how much we want to make of this, but this movie came out just 6 months after the War of the Worlds, which was his huge 2005 summer blockbuster. So it flies under the radar, even though, you know, I think that if you put your thinking cap on, you can find some interesting resonances, thematic resonances with stuff in War of the Worlds.
Yeah, it does, right? So I want to jump into it, but first, before we do that, let's introduce you guys to our audience. Jeff, you're coming back for a second time. You are, so for people ask me all the time, like, hey, I like the idea of your pod, or Jason, I think you're batshit crazy, but I want to listen to it anyway. What episode should I listen to? And Jeff, actually, I've told you this. Like, your episode is one of the ones I always say, it's one of the ones I'm absolutely most proud of. It's, we take this really silly film and then we do these really cool deep dives in it. And just like, it was such a fun time that you and I had to talk together. I was like, carte blanche, whenever you want to come on. And also, you're my friend, right? So, I mean, so there's that. So you want to introduce yourself to the audience who maybe hasn't heard your very first podcast that you did with us and kind of go from there?
Sure. So I'll just say I'm Jeff Melnick. I teach University of Massachusetts, Boston, where I've been for almost 15 years. I teach mostly popular culture classes, but I also do some graduate classes and just kind of intro American studies type stuff. My most recent book that Jason sort of just alluded to is about the cultural legacies of the Manson family. In film and popular culture more generally, in our literary culture. And I've been one way or another, been doing cultural history for 30 years or so since I first dove into the cultural history of Black Jewish relations, which is where, in some ways, where my interest in the Spielberg movie kind of emerges from.
Eric, who are you?
I'm Eric. Eric Baker. I teach at Harvard in the History of Science program. My work is... my first book, which is coming out later this year, is about the history of entrepreneurship in American culture, thinking about sort of popular science and success, pop psychology, how to succeed in business without really trying, or in this case by trying extremely hard by working, you know. But I also I've sort of started a new project. It's about the history of radicalism and American science, especially anti-militarism. I've written a bit about the Vietnam War dissenter Danielle Ellsberg, and have recently done some work around history of anti-nuclear activism. So I'm, you know, I cast a wide net, you know, which is both a blessing and a curse, but it means that could talk about lots of stuff on lots of different podcasts when I find the time.
Well, good. Well, we're going to talk about this thing tonight, right? And I guess maybe there are two big questions I wanted to jump into just right off the bat, Jeff. And this was like, because you came to me and you were like, hey, I want to do Munich, right? And I was like, whatever you want to do is great, right? As long as it's not Hoosiers, we'll do it on the podcast.
That's fair.
But why Munich? And why now?
Yeah, that's a good, I, you know, I'm trying to remember, Jason, when we talked about it and whether it was before October 7th or after October 7th. Because my answer, I tell you truly that I sometimes lie if I remember exactly when it was. But, you know, I've been thinking about this movie for a long time. I thought about it initially in a deep way because I was writing a book about 9/11 and its cultural fallout. And, you know, first spoiler alert, you know, the last shot of this movie, obviously, is of the Twin Towers in an incredibly portentous way. And so I've been thinking about this movie for a long time. And I just want to say up front, because it's the weirdest thing for me about my engagement with the movie, is my attention was called to this movie by one of the strangest figures on the American landscape, cultural landscape, I think, of the last 20 years, who's the film critic Armin White. And if you know Armin White, you know that there's, I mean, first of all, he's been in that era anyway, he was a huge Spielberg promoter, and he really saw these three movies. Eric, when we were talking before, mentioned War of the Worlds, but he saw Minority Report, War of the Worlds, and Munich as this really crucial 9/11 response trilogy. And so Armin White, who's amazingly, I just want to make sure I get this right, he's a Black Catholic gay conservative film critic who back then was writing for the City Sun and the Amsterdam News, these kind of New York, you know, Black papers. And he's now, if I've kept up on things now, he writes for the National Review, I think. So he's fully thrown in with the right wingers. But he was some kind of odd populist. And I like thinking of with him or following him about Spielberg as some kind of like populist attempt to have a political critique of 9/11 patriotism, sort of unthinking celebration of U.S. military might. So I think when I first came to you, that's what I was thinking about. Now, quite frankly, I'm thinking much differently about how this movie plays as a post-October 7th meditation on how much revenge is too much revenge. And that's a question that I think we can certainly talk about. So anyway, I'm sorry, I went on longer than I meant to there. But that's where my initial engagement with this movie was.
Yeah, you know, so we had talked about that. We talked about that, and then you were like, Eric. I was like, okay, cool. Who would we bring to talk? And you were like, Eric Baker. I was like, who is Eric Baker? Right. So, but you were very specific. You're like, Eric Baker's a dude that would really come on here. So, Eric, what's your interest in this particular film?
Well, I think I can't remember. I must have been talking with Jeff about it at some point. You know, that this was, you know, we must have just been talking about movies or something. And I mentioned that I saw this as really, you know, in some ways, Spielberg's kind of unsung masterpiece, his most interesting movie in a lot of ways. You know, and again, it dovetails with a lot of stuff that I've been thinking about lately, again, even before October 7th, in terms of, you know, what are the different kind of values in the name of which you can critique, you know, war and the military abroad? You know, what's the relationship between patriotism and, you know, ideas both in support of war but also against war? You know, what does it mean to be a kind of patriotic war critic? These are things that I'm really interested in, and this movie seems to speak to them so directly. So. You know, but I think in the ultimately, I guess I'm here because I'm one of the few people who shares Jeff's nerddom for this. I think still pretty underrated, underseen, unsung Spielberg flick.
And one thing I'll jump in to say, and I think, and Eric, I totally want to hear what you think about this. Is it's the first and. But certainly not the last movie that Spielberg makes with Tony Kushner. And so I just want to say Kushner's name early on. You know, so Spielberg decides he's going to start making these more explicitly political movies, speaking very much as a Jewish American. And his first move is to draft this incredibly, I mean, on the American landscape anyway, I mean, I don't think Kushner's any kind of communist, but he's some kind of progressive. And so Spielberg kind of put his flag down with Kushner, and you could, I mean, I think, we could try this as an exercise, you can track through the movie and just sort of say, like, these are the real Kushner moments, and these are the real Spielberg moments. You know, like when the nuclear family is reunited at the end of the movie, you're like, oh, it's a Spielberg movie. Of course, the heterosexual nuclear family is reunited. You know, but when Robert the toy maker makes that unbelievable speech in the train station about what, you know, what it means to be a Jew and to have to hang on to a certain kind of righteousness, I mean, that's, it's like, Tony Kushner finally gets to do Angels in America, you know, for a popular, you know, for truly a popular audience. Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, there's the Armand White framing of, you know, this isn't a trilogy with Minority Report or The Worlds. In a way, I like to think of this as actually the first movie in a trilogy of Kushner co-written films, being Lincoln and West Side Story, which I think are really all about the, you know, Spielberg's ambivalence about America, the American project. What does it mean to, you know, critique a country that you love? I mean, especially I think the connection between this movie and Lincoln is very, very close thematically.
Okay, well, that's fascinating, because we've done Lincoln on this pod before. We actually recorded on Minority Report just a few days ago as well. Still haven't done War of the Worlds, but that I'm sure at some point in time that's going to come back. We've done obviously no shortage of Spielberg films where we've talked about Jurassic Park. He's easily the most influential filmmaker of his time. Just the body of work, the range of things he's done, largely everything but rom-coms. So I mean, the guy has this incredible breadth, and he's also really kind of like, we're talking about thinking through this, and I want to talk about specifically now, you know, we're certainly talking about this film now in 2024. This film comes out in 2005, so it's being shot, what, 2004-ish, we can assume. Why then? So let's just kind of backtrack and kind of go back to 2004. Why Steven Spielberg making this movie in 2004, released in 2005?
I mean, 2003 is the turn, right? Like, Eric's gonna laugh at me when I say this, but like, if I think about two great American popular artists who I know Eric and I both care about, Steven Spielberg and Bruce Springsteen, they both, you know, like, that was the tricky thing about the post 9/11 landscape is, you know, Bruce kind of supported the war in Afghanistan, you know, and in without being a real booster, like, there was a certain kind of, for lack of a better phrase, I want to call it like leftish populism that developed around Afghanistan that was supported. But Iraq changed everything, you know, and then certainly when the Abu Ghraib photos came out, that really changed everything. So Jason, I think your timeline is absolutely perfect, right? Is that there's that real turn around 2003 into early 2004, where that kind of left populism wasn't such an appealing or seductive position anymore. Yeah. So I'll leave that there for now.
And even, you know, you get this shift, even like, you know, in early 2003, obviously liberal America is very split on the war. You know, you have people, you know, magazines like the New Republic, The Atlantic, you know, people supporting the war, obviously, you know, a lot of Democratic politicians voting to authorize the war. You know, a year later, 2004, you know, you have insurgency, your, you know, mission accomplished has come and gone. As Jeff was alluding to, revelations about U.S. torture and other kind of human rights abuses. And, you know, by the time that, you know, you're gearing up for the John Kerry campaign in 2004, you know, all of liberal America has become intensely polarized against the war. And it's a really dramatic turn of events. And I think that people start reflecting on this, you know, the sort of 2001 moment, you know, people start to think, you know, wow, we really kind of got swept up in this whole thing. And what does that say about ourselves? You know, how do we move forward? You know, how do we sort of reconcile everything that we've learned about, you know, what the U.S. has done since the invasion of Iraq with our kind of image, our hopes, or like sense of what America is all about? And I think that comes across really clearly in the movie. I mean, I think the Golda Meir speech early on the film, I mean, it's like a almost too on the nose. You know, she's like, she says something like, you know, there comes a time where, you know, every civilization needs to, you know, reckon with its values and, like, you know, the compromises that it's willing to make.
Compromise
like,
with its values.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that like that question is just on the minds of so many liberals in America, you know, including Spielberg. That's like exactly the question people are asking.
Absolutely. And that's where I want to say, like, that's where the movie opens up, like Golda Meir is articulating what in the US we basically call a liberal Zionist position, right? That Zionism is a necessary fact of Jewish life post-Holocaust. And then there's these sort of critical questions we have to ask self-reflexively, right? That's one reason I really hesitate to sort of fetishize 10/7 as a date that we use in the same way that we fetishize 9/11 as a date, because it makes it hard, and Eric, I think, was hinting at this already, it makes it hard to remember that those dates didn't start history, right? Like those dates are embedded in much longer and really complicated histories. And so, I mean, I think Eric's absolutely right that by 2004, and then obviously by the time the movie comes out, and this is like a real... this is a hobby horse of mine, but one that I really want to underline, is by summer of 2005, then you get the flood after Hurricane Katrina, and then whatever fake sense of consensus there had been just completely falls apart, right? And the kind of racial dynamics of the so-called patriotic, you know, surge after 9/11 just completely falls apart.
Yeah, you go from, you know, George W. Bush winning an election, you know, winning the popular vote in 2004 to, you know, having base at that point, the worst approval rating of any president in history, you know, in less than a year, essentially. So it really is a this kind of dizzy making, yes, turn, where all, you know, all of this stuff that I, you know, people kind of wanted to stuff under the rug a little bit in the aftermath of 9/11 for the sake of sort of national unity, all of a sudden the floodgates open, and it seems like it's time for a reckoning.
I'm just really glad that Eric mentioned the Golda Meir speech, because one of the strange things about the movies is that the two, I think, fullest articulations of sort of Zionist rightness come from women, right? One is Golda Meir and one is Avner's mother, who makes this, I mean, depending on where you sit, either terrifying or incredibly moving speech about the dead spirits of the ancestors who were all on the mountain with her as she prayed for the birth of Avner in Israel, you know, the first generation of, you know, of state-born, of Sabras, you know, Israeli-born babies. And so in the movie, it's got this kind of interesting deflection, because the militarism is all male, of course, but the kind of theory that undergirds it is this kind of female spirit.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I think this movie's relationship, I kept waffling back and forth about where the movie came down on Zionism and on liberal Zionism. I think it's like no other movie of its like mainstream pedigree, you know, it is probably the single most astute critique of Israel that Hollywood has ever produced. But it's still, you know, there are still some real, I mean, my critique, which it was actually the sort of what I was going to pivot into. I think a lot of its critique, there's this weird sort of juxtaposition of Israel with America. I mean, ultimately he rejects Israel for America, you know, so it feels like it's anti-Zionism almost comes at the expense of a sort of too rosy view as the American project, at least for my taste. And there's also there's a kind of cop out. The setting of the film is useful to this, because, you know, in that early 70s moment, I mean, you're starting to get, you know, Nixon, Kissinger, you know, the U.S. has started to treat Israel as more, you know, more of a client state, but it's not, you know, this is kind of the pivotal decade. America, you don't get the sense of America as the kind of holding the purse or the puppet strings, in a way that you would have to, you know, if you were making a movie set later in the 20th century, about, like, you know, whatever, Lebanon.
No, I think that's right. And we see so little of the U.S. except this quick, you know, stoop sense of like, look, all the different women are together in the USA, you know, like there's that kind of like little Brooklyn dream moment there.
Yeah. You know, a nation of immigrants. Again, it's this like, it's kind of, it's almost dizzy making a little bit, because it's like using, in some ways it's like using Israel as an allegory for like post 9/11 America. But there's also this move of like critiquing Israel in the name of like the superiority of the pluralist, inherently pluralist, multicultural project. So the message of the movie almost becomes like, in this post 9/11 moment, America needs to like remember what makes it better than Israel, which is like a fascinating message in its complexity. And it's,
right. No, I was thinking about that because I was rewatching the last scene, and they're on the promenade, you know, wherever that is, Brooklyn Heights, whatever. And there's like a black guy leaning, you know, against
exactly.
the railing.
I'm
like, a black guy, you know, like amazing miracle, a black guy in New York, you know, like,
Here's a good starting point here for us to jump back into, if I will, because I want to, people who are not intimately familiar, you know, I've got people on social media coming to me saying, Jason, you're a historian, can you make sense of this? And I'm like, I have no clue what's going on in the Middle East, in Palestine, and Israel. These are far beyond. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's an attorney this morning. I was like, you must get these kinds of questions where people are asking these different kinds of law. And you're like, I don't know. He's like, yeah, of course, you know. And I feel a bit moronic at times, perhaps, but also that's it's so far beyond my area of expertise, my own, frankly, scholarly interests and things like that. And I kind of want to maybe – let's define a couple of these terms here, because I think that a lot of these ideas, both in the film and also in our current geopolitical situation, really hinge on ideas of being able to understand where, you know, what Israel is, who the Jewish people are, what Palestine is, who the Palestinian people are, this idea of Zionism, which I still don't completely understand, because I grew up in the sticks in Kentucky as in a Southern Baptist household. This was as far away from my working knowledge as I had. And frankly, even at 46, it's my own ignorance of the world. And I'm not really afraid to admit that. I think this is an opportunity to kind of talk about this and maybe some of these things. So maybe we can basically open up with some definitions about like where we are, say, in 1972, about who, what is Israel? What's the right terms here to use when I'm thinking about Israel, Palestine, the Jewish state, Palestinian liberation, all of these kind of ideas. Can we kind of jump in from there?
I'll defer to Professor Melnick on this one.
So sure you were going to get in the game right there. So here's what I'll say, and I'll try to – I mean, I think you're asking a great and unanswerable question, Jason. Where we are in 1972 is we're after 1967. I mean, I think that's the really key thing to note. There's a war in the Middle East in 1967, and it's the moment when Israel, to a lot of the rest of the – developing world, comes to seem as much more aligned with what we used to call the first world than with the third world, right? So 1967, Six-Day War is when Israel begins taking over, you know, the Golan Heights, part of what we now call the West Bank. So Israel, at least for our concerns as U.S. historians, this is for me as a scholar of Black Jewish relations, a major moment when a huge number of African Americans begin to see Palestinians as kind of anti-colonial siblings, right? As involved in a struggle against the great world powers, of which Israel is now seeming either to be one or to be at least a very close client of, right? And so that's 72 is in some ways to me, and this terrible thing that happens at the Olympics, you know, this slaughtering of Israeli athletes, this fascinating moment where Israel in the kind of, you know, common sense, conventional wisdom of the United States, is at once this incredibly appealing group of victims, and also this incredibly powerful, you know, kind of first world nuclear power, right? And so that's the movie, you know, and Eric was talking about this a little bit earlier. The movie is very much interested in figuring out that both and about Israel, right? Is how can it be this kind of eternal victim state created out of the ashes of the Holocaust, and built on this mythology that they took a land that had no people for a people who had no land. That was the old motto, you know, of Zionists in what previously had been called Palestine. And then there was the actual Palestinian people who were saying, hey, were here. The land was not without people. The land had hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands of whom, if not hundreds of thousands, were forced from their land in 1948. So what we in the U.S. generally refer to as the founding of the, quote, state of Israel is called by Palestinians the Nakba, the disaster, right? So it's two really, you know, competing origin stories, you know, for lack of a better phrase. And the film, you know, the moment we really see that, and I'm happy to stay with the history, but just to bring it to the film for a second, is in that safe house, you know, in Germany, when Avner and his Palestinian counterpart, Ali, are kind of arguing about history and about possible futures. And they cannot have a conversation because they are in like two different, I mean, it's a great movie scene, but they can't really have a conversation because they inhabit like literally like two different rhetorical universes. They don't have any agreement about what's happened, you know, in the past. And that's in the US, one of the things that we're being asked right now to litigate is these very, very different narratives about how the state of Israel was founded and, you know, who supported it and who were the victims in that moment. So that's my two cents.
Yeah. So just to build on that, I mean, the other thing to say about this 1972 moment, you know, which we know now, Spielberg knows making this movie in 2004, they didn't know at the time, but I think looms large for the movie is that we're right on the edge of another inflection point, which is 1973, the Yom Kippur War. Israel's territorial possessions expand even further. And there's a real shift in domestic Israeli politics, the total political marginalization of the, you know, relatively left-wing social democratic labor party that, you know, really controlled this Israeli politics from the founding to that moment, and the founding of the Likud party, Benjamin Netanyahu's party, right wing across the political spectrum, you know, very aggressively militarist. And so I think it's clear to me that, you know, Spielberg looking back sees this as a kind of moment where the Israelis kind of face it, or they're facing a choice. You know, what kind of country do they want to become? You know, do they want to stay true to, I think, a vision that Spielberg really sympathizes with, this kind of initial liberal labor Zionism, you know, or are they going to pivot in a more right-wing, hardline, militarist direction? So there are all these, I mean, Jeff was talking about how the kind of liberal Zionist view is often spoken by women in this movie. And there's also a lot of like childbirth rhetoric and metaphors in this movie. And I think, you know, Spielberg wants to see, you know, the wants us to think about this moment as in some ways Israel is still in the process of being born at this moment. And there's a kind of fork in the road. You know, it's not totally clear yet what Israel is going to be. And I think that it's, you know, ultimately, it's clear to me watching the movie that for Spielberg, this is a tragic story. You know, Israel essentially chooses wrong. They abandon this initial vision that Spielberg is very sympathetic with, and you know, ultimately, it kind of they lose their moral authority to the point where, you know, Spielberg really at the end he sees the United States as the kind of repository of. At least potentially, if it lives up to its values, it can be this place of, you know, pluralist, multicultural democracy. And that's why the protagonist, again, you know, spoilers at the end of the movie, essentially chooses to leave Israel behind for America. You know, it's no longer a home for him.
Yeah, there's a couple of different things here that are going on here too. You know, I learned this term Sabra. Am I saying this correctly? Avner refers to himself as this very often. I did not know this word. I had to actually. I thought I understood it as I was watching the film. And I had to kind of go back and Google it as I went along. The idea of a Jewish diaspora, the, you know, plays huge roles in this. And Eric, you're just alluding to this. Certainly Avner's family being German immigrants and then moved back where he was born in Israel, if I'm correct. And then, of course, he moves back into the United States later on, which leads me to the idea, to the question of this. We obviously have a large Jewish population here in the United States. How are the events of, say, 1972 in Munich being viewed by Jewish Americans here in the U.S.? And not only that, but being maybe remembered some 50 years later now?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question, Jason, because like the we were talking a little bit before about this, the Israel cannot exist without a narrative of victimhood, right? Like, and it's the truly horrifying 20th century, one of the major narratives and realities of victimhood is the Nazi Holocaust and the number of Jews, you know, who were slaughtered there. And so, you know, we saw this obviously October 7th with the way that the Israel, you know, sort of propaganda forces and their supporters in the U.S. really wanted to use the word Holocaust about what happened on October 7th. And when they weren't using Holocaust, very often they were using pogrom, you know, which refers to an earlier history of Eastern European persecution of Jews, particularly in Russia, right? So 72, in some ways, it's this terrible thing that happens, but it's also a usable event for Zionists in the United States. And that's, you know, I'm thinking about the great book. I'm gesturing to my kitchen because I see the book over there that Amy Kaplan wrote, her last book before she died, called Our American Israel. And it's about the Americanization of the idea of Israel through novels and films like Exodus, through political speech, through various kinds of, you know, community campaigns. And as somebody who was a young Jewish boy in the 1970s, I could tell you this was very much the Munich tragedy was like immediately became part of like our canon. You know what I mean? Like it became part of like our like psalms that we said, you know, like, and I mean that, you know, obviously metaphorically, but like it very much fit into the story. And it happened in Germany, for fuck's sake. Like, you know, like it, like the setting couldn't have been more perfect, right? Or more horrifying, is that Jews are being killed in Germany again, right? And so I know from, you know, my own liberal Zionist raising, that meant we had to like collect more quarters to plant trees in Israel. That's something we literally did as part of our Hebrew school education. We collected money to plant trees in Israel. And it very much did fit into this narrative of fraughtness, right? And of the necessity of Israel. And that's, you know, that's deep in American Jewish culture. And we're seeing it in our own moment in ways that are, you know, I feel like I was naive because I thought maybe it had been attenuated somewhat, you know, in the last 50 years or so since I was a kid, but it hasn't. You know, if anything, this is the fiercest moment of Jewish victimhood being sort of rearticulated as an excuse to do absolutely anything, right? I mean, the horror of there being hostages is real. The horror of the 1,000+ Israeli Jews who were killed on October 7th is horrifying. But the fact that that's foreclosed any other conversation, it's because any conversation about the loss of Palestinian life, which is frankly unbearable, is, I think, a testament to how powerful that Zionist narrative is in the United States. And, you know, back to something Eric said before, is to his credit, although there's a lot that I don't like about how Spielberg frames this movie, to his credit, Spielberg is at least he's at least calling the question, right? He's at least saying, is it good for us the way we live this Zionist narrative? Is it good for Jews? Is it good for Israel? Like, I think that's a clear no, as Eric's already said. But is it good for anybody? And that the movie really struggles with that. Yeah.
The only thing I'd add is just to say that I think this is also an important moment in the kind of crystallization of a view of the kind of conflation of any sort of Palestinian resistance with terrorism. You know, this category comes in some ways it anticipates what happens, you know, later during the 20th and 21st century with the first and second Intifada. But there's, you know, this, the memory of Munich is, you know, held up to say, you know, what Palestinian self-advocacy means is, you know, trying to capture and kill civilians. so it becomes this. And again, I think one of the transgressive parts of this film is really drawing a parallel between the activities of the Black September members who carried out the Munich attacks and the Mossad agents who, you know, ultimately try to track them down. And again, this incredible conversation in this, you know, hotel that Jeff was talking about earlier really, I think, crystallizes this. You know, there's this sort of sense that, you know, Palestinian militants have killed, you know, have hurt innocent people, but so have Israeli militants. And so there's a question, you know, whose kind of revenge is validated, you know, what forms of violence become terrorism versus acceptable use of military force. These are questions that Spielberg poses explicitly, and, you know, and as we see there, it's still, you know, hard to believe we're almost 20 years after this, but, you know, that's where we are. And these questions are still, I think, as relevant as ever.
Absolutely. And not for nothing. One of the things the movie does so powerfully for me is it's a very meta movie. It's like a movie about storytelling and who's on the mic. Like, there's those early scenes where, you know, Spielberg shows us all the different foreign correspondents at the Olympics, and he's reminding us, like, everyone's telling this story in their own language, right? Like, it's this great, like, duh, but worthwhile moment in the movie. And then, of course, the first Palestinian Black September member who is killed is that amazing, you know, he's a beautiful character, that amazing kind of poetic professor who, you know, gives the talk about how he's been translating Scheherazade and, you know, how you tell stories and who gets to tell the story is an important kind of power. And, you know, and then he goes into and I had to look this up today to remind myself, but he goes into this store after his talk and buys some groceries, and there's a TV up above the store counter where there's a black and white movie playing. And so real Spielberg heads will know this already, but the movie that's playing is the John Ford Western, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, right? Which is also a movie about how much violence is okay. Like, if there's a, you know, and
about historical, you know, the whitewashing of historical memory. And
yeah, exactly right. The most famous line from that movie is the journalist who says, you know, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend, right? It's this like amazing John Ford, you know, like, you can hate John Ford for that because obviously he printed a lot of legends. But if you think about Spielberg putting that in there as a kind of like self-critique moment, right? Of saying like, we got to get past the legends here. We got to get past this kind of heroic narrative of Zionism as kind of blameless and necessary, right? To me, the movie, like, that's where it gains its power, is just saying, you know, and Eric has said this already, I'm really just kind of underlining it, like, is it okay to ask questions? Like, is it okay to challenge the overarching Zionist narrative of necessity, heroism, nobility, you know, Jewish value, you know, the value of Jewish lives post-Holocaust above all others, right? So that's, I mean, that's really powerful in the movie.
I want to ask you guys about the film. I want to jump into, we started to ask about these ideas, these larger meta questions, because, you know, coming into the film, you know, I didn't have, you know, as we said earlier, I didn't have a relationship to this film. I was like, oh, cool. You know, going into it, I knew nothing about it. I was like, oh, it's a revenge film. I like revenge films. I like spy movies and espionage and all this stuff. And that's not what, you know, this movie is a thought piece. It's deeper. I mean, there's action to it, certainly, right? And you know, for people who like that kind of stuff, but it's really, it's using that stuff to really do these deeper thoughts, mm-hmm. and things like that. So I want to talk about the movie itself, and maybe we can, I want to get into those early scenes of the actual events of Munich. But before we do so, can we talk a little bit about the casting? Jeff, you and I had kind of talked a little bit last night. I think Eric Bana in this is just, why, and I've said this before, why Eric Bana is not one of the biggest movie stars in Hollywood, I am continually shocked by. He, I don't know. What are our thoughts on the way this film is cast? And also, my question is this. This is actually a very globally diverse cast. The actors are – many of the actors are not themselves Jewish, to my knowledge. Is that – does that matter? So thoughts on the cast themselves.
Well, I have to say the casting choice that that fascinates me most is Daniel Craig, who plays the kind of the most hardcore, most militant member of this Mossad cell. And this, you know, this casting, I mean, I love Daniel Craig. Some would describe me as a little Daniel Craig obsessed. But you know, there's a lot to be there you go. you know, so of course this is right before he's cast as James Bond, which kind of ties this movie in retrospect to this whole kind of universe of spy film, you know, spy mythology, action hero kind of stuff in American culture. But also weirdly, because Daniel Craig is one of these actors who's not Jewish, he also stars 3 years later in a film called Defiance, where he plays a leader in a Polish partisan group in Poland during World War II. I'm not sure exactly why, you know, I don't totally know what it means, but to me it must mean something that Daniel Craig is cast twice in the aughts as a Jewish, you know, revenge-seeking militant.
I mean, and blonde hair and blue-eyed, which Spielberg never lets you forget in the movie. Like, we get more close-ups of Daniel Craig's blue eyes than I think of anybody's body in the movie, you know. And he's South African in the movie. Like, yes. Spielberg is also really – so that's not about casting, but he's inviting us on a character level to think about – what did Jews look like in South Africa? Well, they look like Nazis, you know, like, and that's, I mean, to think of in 1970s terms, that's like Boys from Brazil shit. Like that's, you know, Daniel Craig just looks like he couldn't look less Jewish. I mean, I love your question, Jason, because, you know, Spielberg is one of the few people, I think, with the juice in Hollywood to make an incredibly Jewish movie with all these non-Jews, and nobody said boo about it. And Eric Bana is like, I mean, I've watched a lot of movies about Jewish characters, believe me, and I have never seen somebody capture the furrowed brow of the Jewish man more effectively. You know, now I'm watching myself on screen, you know. I'm like,
if everyone could just lean into the camera right now, you know, I'll bring my Southern heathen in right now. But right. Yes, so.
But Arizona, like, and the movie really wants you to see that he does a lot of his acting, like between the eyes, like, you know, and he really – from fairly early on, Spielberg wants us to see that Bana's got that, like, that what we think of as a certain kind of like Jewish self-reflexiveness or self-critique, and he captures that amazingly well. There's plenty of other Jewish characters, including like his handler, and guys, help me out on who plays Ephraim. I can't remember who is cast. I think because he
Jeffrey
looks like
Rush. Him. Yeah,
Jeffrey Rush, of course. Thank
Jeffrey
you.
Jeffrey Rush is so good in this.
He's amazing in it, but he's either cast or costumed so that we think what Jew does he look like? He looks like Henry Kissinger, right? Yeah. Yeah. So it's like Spielberg is. So I want to answer your question in a shorter way than I possibly have committed myself to now. But basically, I think Spielberg's having a lot of fun. Like he's being very playful and destabilizing and a little bit of a bad boy. You know what I mean? Like he's. You know, there's plenty of Jewish actors he could have pulled in for this, and he really went. And you said, Jason, I just want to sort of like push back on something you said because you started to say something right, and then you pulled back from it. Like you said, it's like a spy movie, but then it's not. I'm like, but it always is a spy movie. Like that's part of one of the pleasures of it is that it's like Ocean's 5. You know, it's like these guys, like the toy maker and the accountant, and the you know, like, and they all show up on the tarmac together, and the movie hangs on to that, and that's one of the I think one of the real gifts of it. Yeah.
Well, and it's funny. I mean, you know, we think about, I mean, so, you know, in some ways we think about early Eric Bana is a very kind of comedic actor, but right in the run up to this, you know, he was in Black Hawk Down. He was the Hulk.
So good in that movie.
And then he was Hector in Troy. So he's like a lot of these, I mean, in some ways kind of over the top sort of like macho action heroes. And I think that Spielberg wants us to think about, you know, there, I agree with Jeff. He's having a bit of fun. I think he wants us to think about the kind of, in some ways, the costs of this sort of, like, you know, what does it mean to like think of yourself as, you know, as an action movie guy, like the protagonists of this film. I think in every case, they think of themselves as, like, you know, they're like these, you know, heroes of a war movie. And then in some ways we watch them go on this journey where they realize that, you know, the movie that they're in, it is actually, you know, more morally complicated and darker.
Right. And one of the characters even says that to Eric Bana's character. I think it's Hans who says to him, "I knew guys like you in the army. You'll do anything as long as you can keep running forward." Right. And so, like, that, when you were saying that, I'm picturing Eric Bana in those other movies, like, he's always running forward. And in this movie, he gets in trouble when he sits and he's on the bar stool with the Dutch woman, when he's on the edge of his bed in the scene where he really starts losing it. Like, when he sits still, he's in trouble, right? Because, like, he's an action hero. He should not sit still. Yeah.
Yeah, I get the sense that, you know, his character, Abner, just simply does not want to be in this movie. You know, versus Daniel Craig's Steve, you know, with Craig's character, right? You just, Jeff and I talked about this the other day, you just see Bond leaching out of this man, add another 25 pounds of muscle, and that becomes Daniel Craig in like another year. But with this one, it's like you can see Abner just kind of grabbing on, like he's being. He's like, he's grabbing onto the door frame and just being pushed out and fighting with everything he's got. He's into this situation. And
that's great.
I think it helps us to maybe internalize maybe the points that Spielberg's trying to make here, which is like, what are we doing? You know, is this something we should be heading straight for? And of course, like you're saying, Jeff, he's thrust into the story regardless. And it's these moments when he stops is when he's actually in danger. So you've got this real incredible friction going on.
Great.
You know,
I love that. That's a real great postmodern kind of take where the movie is kind of aware of itself as a movie and the character is like, get me out of this fucking movie. Like this is the worst movie to be in as a main character. When he finally gets to have a sex scene at the end, it's one of the unhappiest sex scenes that has ever committed to film, right? And he, like, we all hate, or I'll speak for myself, like, me and everybody I read at the time was like, oh, why'd Spielberg put the sex? And when I watched it this time, it was like, right, that's where he's showing us that, like, this guy's ruined. Like, he's just...
Oh, he's broken. He's broken in so many ways. And I was eating stir fry. So the whole time I was sitting on my couch watching this, I had to sit here like, I can't eat right now. It's an movement. Can we talk about the opening scene? Because I found this, I had not seen this film in many years. It is a brutally shot opening scene and necessarily so, I think. What were your thoughts on showing what happens in Munich? Does it have to be so brutal?
Well, I think in some ways Spielberg's way of sort of like staking his, you know, debate opponent a little bit. You know, it's like, okay, I'll grant you, you know, the like maximum horror of what happened, you know, but I'll still ask these questions, because if the opening scene isn't, you know, like that, or if it's not shown in the same way or not shown at all, you know, whatever, then invariably, you know, the criticism is like, okay, well, you know, easy for you to say, like, you're not really grappling with the you know, the violence or the cruelty, the horror of what happened originally. So, I mean, I think that from a rhetorical perspective, it actually does, it does kind of have to be in there. I mean, you could imagine someone saying, you know, well, it's you know, Spielberg, like he starts that way to, you know, get you kind of sympathizing with the main characters, and, you know, but again, I think that's what he wants to do. He wants to get you, you know, in the mindset, and then kind of show where it leads.
And he also really, I mean, one of the things that I think he does really effectively, and so effectively I kind of hate it, is that, like, he gives you these couple minutes right at that in that opening scene of depoliticized Olympics. Like, it's just a bunch of guys, right? And it's literally American guys who help
helping
the Palestinians.
These dudes over the fence.
It's just sports. We're all, and they're real bro-y, you know, like the bro-iest bro kind of athletes. They're a little drunk. They're like, yeah, I'll give you a boost, my man. You know, it's just like, and it's just kind of all, you know, hail fellow, well met kind of stuff. And that's, of course, a bizarre myth. Speaking of narratives, that the Olympics were ever, I mean, it's national, well, like whatever. It's just like this kind of sports nationalism, but like he's giving you that. And I think Eric's absolutely right. He's like giving you the kind of soft power version of the Olympics. This is just good fun for the boys. And then this terrible thing happens, which is going to haunt everybody in the movie, including Avner, you know, up until the last scene of the movie. You cannot shake yourself of the terrifying violence. It's really, I mean, it's like Clockwork Orange, you know, like nightmare making violence, right? But it's the rest of the movie. It's like it's a really long movie. We should just say that in case anybody's listening to this who hasn't seen the movie. It's a really long movie. And that opening scene is pretty extended, but like then for like a solid 2 hours and 20 minutes, we don't really give a shit about what happened like in Munich per se. Like, it's the title of the movie, it's the occasion of the movie, but like all those scenes with the Papa and Louis in France, and all the scene with the Dutch woman, the scene with the handlers, the scene with like there'll be mention of Munich, but like that's just kind of like, that's like deep background, right? So I think Eric's absolutely right, is that we need to see the horror, because the rest of the movie, the whole kind of metaphysical conversation has no weight without the horror up front. And it's the Holocaust, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Speaking of that, one of the things I was most eager to talk about with you fellas is this sort of almost kind of interlude scene with Michael Lonsdale as the father of Matthew Almerich, their sort of handler, the person who gives them the, you know, tells them where to find these people that they're tracking down. And, you know, they're sort of in this homestead, this kind of almost like monastic sort of community, except it's like this kind of crime ring where they like sell the locations of, you know, wanted men to the highest bidder. But it's the, you know, this was honestly, I mean, I spent a lot of time trying to think, you know, what, why, and it goes on and on. And it seems to be a total digression or interruption to the main plot. I felt like, you know, there must be, this must have had some, you know, thematic significance for Spielberg. And I have some ideas as to what it might be, but I was curious to get your takes.
Yeah, he's a great character, isn't he? You know, I mean, first of all, like his son is named Louis, which is a French name, but also the French word for just him, right? Like, so it's just like any guy, you know, here's any guy, like, and any guy is helping fund terrorists and states and spy organizations, maybe. And it's just like, I mean, I love how Spielberg uses that family to remind us that this is mafia shit down, you know, like down to the bone, right? Like, governments are the mob. Families are the mob. Israel is definitely the fucking mob. You know, like, it's just, and he's, you know, he's got that great scene where he asks Avner to help him, you know, come prepare some food in the sink. And he shows Avner his hands. He says, let me see your hands. And he says, oh, you know, such a pity. We, you know, I wanted to be a chef, but I've got these butcher hands, you know? And it's this like reminder that like all the men in the movie pretty much are butchers. And then so he's like the butcher, but he's also like the philosophical voice. And now, bracket, Jeff's going to say something kind of Talmudic and numerological and bizarre. But when he finally gets to give Avner his big speech, and he quotes Ecclesiastes, and he says, the race is not to the swift, nor the, you know, the battle to the strong. That happens to be Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 11. Like, it's literally a 9-11 flight. It's like, so he's there to remind us that like bad shit's been happening. It's going to keep happening. You know, it doesn't matter who you are. It's coming to your door too. You know what I mean? Like, and so like, I can't imagine, I mean, that's a Tony Kushner moment, if there's any, is that the strong will be brought, you know, to their knees, and that Avner should know that he's you know, the hunter and the prey, just like, it, you know, like that's the kind of big allegorical weight of the movie, right?
Well, and there's the sense of it's almost more noble. It's more noble to know that you're like a gangster than to actually be a gangster and think that you're you know, some kind of patriotic hero. So I like that. Wow. Ecclesiastes 9:11. That's something.
Yeah. And that's the content. No, but Eric, I think that's absolutely right. It's that, like, that it's self-reflexiveness. And that's the real sort of like Tony Kushner's, you know, heart of the movie. That's one of the reasons I found West Side Story to be a shockingly good, powerful movie, which I did not expect at all, is that he really tries to imbue almost all the characters with self-reflexiveness about who they are in New York and, you know, what kind of turf battles they're being stitched into that aren't for their benefit, you know? That's in this movie, that family, I mean, they really are like, that's where there is like this, I'm glad you said gangster, because it is like a mini, you know, and Jason said spy movie before, but like, this is like a mini gangster movie in the middle of this kind of transatlantic global politics movie. And there are kind of gangsters. We love those gangsters in American film history, right? The ones who, he was good to his mother, you know, like he always gave turkeys away on, you know, like we love, like he dresses nice. He knows how to put out a nice meal, right?
Yeah. That cooking scene is, you know, straight out of Martin Scorsese. I mean, how many iconic Scorsese, you know, gangsters making food scenes are there?
And Obner's the other great cook in the movie, right? Like whenever the shit has just jumped off or is about to jump off, Obner's chopping in the, you know, and putting out this spread that's like, you know, just gorgeous. Like it's operatic almost, like how, you know, the colors and the textures. And so Papa is, you know, he's the model for that. He's like, if you're going to be a gangster, like feed your family. Like that's, you know, that's the prime directive. Yeah.
I want to ask you guys, you know, we get into this particular film. You know, it certainly feels like, you know, we've got this deeper exploration of Obner, who starts off really as this like guy going in on what he perceives to be this noble mission. I'm going to avenge my people, avenge my country, avenge these athletes. And then this gradual deepening of like Obner realizing just how deep this goes into it. It's like, I'm hesitant to say. Well, I don't know what I'm afraid to say here, frankly, because this is where I'm afraid. This is where my own ignorance of the situation jumps into. But it certainly, there is a darkness to the state that is revealed throughout the film. Am I correct here? That certainly seems like what Spielberg's pointing out to is like, hey, this is not, you know, Obner's continuing to question. Are we getting the right guys? And there's this lie, it's like, well, don't worry about it. They're bad people.
Yeah. There are some moments where I was reminded almost despite myself of my favorite of his movies, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is very much a movie about, you know, state secrecy. There's a kind of men in black element to these sort of machinations. You know, that movie is also about, you know, kind of what the government doesn't want you to know. And I think there are some scenes, again, cinematically, where he kind of goes back to that well. And I think you're exactly right, Jason, this idea that, I mean, I think, you know, one of Spielberg's overriding concerns thematically throughout his career, I think his ethos as a filmmaker is, you know, democracy, accessibility. You know, he's the kind of the ultimate populist entertainer. And I think there are a lot of historians and, you know, critics who've made this point, but there's a kind of essential tension of the kind of secrecy demanded by the sort of modern warfare state and democracy. I think that's something that really outrages Spielberg, you know, the idea that the real decisions are being made behind the scenes.
And not to jump too far ahead in his career, but like I can't help, Eric, hearing you say that, to think about the Fabelmans movie where, you know, the barely fictionalized origin story is that it's your own parents who have been lying to you all along, right? And the only way to gain control is with a camera, right? Like the kind of, you know, falseness of the nuclear family and the broken promises of, you know, heterosexual marriage and child, you know, rearing is that's brutal in the movie. Cause like in Munich, that's like, I mean, there's all these brutally violent scenes. I mean, I've watched this movie. I used to teach a class on 9/11. So I probably watched this movie 10, 12 times. And the scene that always gets me is when they kill the Dutch woman.
Thinking the exact same thing.
Right. And I wonder if we even have the same idea of just that literal and kind of physical conversation they have about whether to leave her uncovered or covered, right? Like whether there's like any dignity in, you know, the work that they're doing, and they all realize afterwards that they messed up, and you know, like excuse me, like she's like the equivalent of Papa and Lou, you know, like she's a bit, you know, it's strictly business, nothing personal, you know? And she gets treated with just utter disrespect in the moment of her death. And that's like in the Spielberg universe, that just seems like the great sin, you know, and that really seems to be where Avner starts unraveling, you know, when he realizes that, you know, that he's gone to like, you know, whatever in the movie logic, you know, he's finally gone too far. That's brutal, right? That scene, like I think we're being instructed to cringe pretty hard. Yeah.
I think so. It's weird because of a film that is ostensibly about avenging the deaths of these athletes and going after Palestinian folks. The death that like sticks with you is actually this Dutch woman on a boat. And that's, you're absolutely right. I was fighting against that scene because I was like, this can't be the scene that sticks with me. Why is this the scene of all the scenes in this film? Why is this even more than that really terrific butcher's hands scene, right? It's such a weird, and again, for a movie about murder and revenge and terrorism and state secrets, this movie feels about like the loss of innocence, and it's so, you know, I don't know, boy, yeah, that scene is tough to watch, man. And just, you're absolutely right. The way they were like, no, leave her exposed, because that was like, it's almost like spitting on her corpse.
Yeah.
Right.
When there's a sense of, you know, cycles of violence, which recurs throughout the movie, you know, you get a, you know, okay, so there's, you know, these people who kill people, and then we have to kill them. Then there's the person who's going to kill us, and then we have to kill the person who's going to, you know, you get this almost sort of Byzantine sort of set of layers of grudges and feuds. And, you know, I think there's, you may want to, I mean, I think an open question about this movie is the extent to which, you know, it makes sense to sort of focus so strongly on the kind of the motive of revenge, the emotion of revenge as what's kind of driving the whole process, you know, as opposed to, you know, maybe more kind of like cynical or, you know, Machiavellian kind of geopolitical calculations. You know, but as a movie that does interrogate that emotion, the desire for revenge, I do think that, you know, the sort of multiplication of feuds that you see over the course of the movie.
And that's where it ties back to Minority Report, right? Because like there's pre-crime, right? Like yeah, you have to kill Palestinians because even if they haven't done anything to you yet, they're going to, because of what you've done to them, right? Like you got it exactly right. Like it's those cycles. And so I think Jason, I sympathize with your worry about caring too much about the Dutch woman, but I think the movie, in my mind anyway, sets her up. The movie's got a bunch of doubles in it. You know, Avner and Ali obviously are doubles of each other. And she's clear to me anyway, clearly the double of Avner's wife, Daphne. Like they look vaguely similar, you know, kind of cut more or less the same. And like that's where Avner, like if you jump to the end of the movie, Avner realizes somebody's going to be coming for his wife, right? His woman, right? Like, and that's where he loses it and runs into the Israeli embassy, and, you know, where he clearly becomes like a man possessed, right? Is that realization that if you're going to kind of subscribe to revenge as a reasonable political solution, then there's no end to that, right? And so Avner then literally says that to Ephraim seconds before we see, you know, the World Trade Center looming on the horizon, right? Is that there's no peace at the end of this, right? Like that's, and it's like, whatever, it's Spielberg, it's a little heavy-handed, like nobody ever accused him of underplaying a scene, right? But that's a great moment, right? Where Avner, if this is like a coming of age story on some level or coming to consciousness story, that's where Avner realizes like, oh, I just kind of like added fuel to the fire. Like I did not do anything to settle scores. I just created new scores, you know? Yeah.
Always a coming of age story with Spielberg.
It is. That's yeah, absolutely. It's always a coming of age story. Yeah.
Are there parts of this film that drive you nuts?
Yeah. Well, I was talking with Jeff while we were having some technical difficulties earlier and we were chatting. I mean, I think one of the difficulties of this movie is that I think that the ending really, really drives this home is that it ultimately ends up critiquing Israel, you know, rejecting a lot of the sort of ideologies that surround the Israeli project in the name of American values. You know, Avner comes to realize that it's, you know, America rather than Israel is the home of, you know, pluralism, multiculturalism, democracy, these things that, you know, Israel in his conclusion is just too fundamentally sort of ethno-nationalist to embody. And I think that that's, you know, that's clearly Spielberg's hope for America. And, you know, he knows that it's imperfect, you know, and again, so much about Lincoln, West Side Story is these movies where he continues to kind of grapple with, you know, okay, well, like, what does it mean if this is what America is supposed to be, this, you know, multicultural pluralist democracy, but, you know, in reality, it falls short of that ideal. But for me, it's, I still, you know, I'm someone where it feels like for this movie, it almost like there's a way that I think it kind of undermines its critique of, you know, 9/11, like America in the age of 9/11, in the way that it sort of winds up juxtaposing America as the kind of like positive foil to Israel at the end of the movie. So again, it's I wouldn't go so far as to say that it drives me nuts, but it's the one aspect of this movie that I does you know makes me a little unsure, you know, or that doesn't quite land for me.
So I think what I have to say is related and maybe like a co-signing of what Eric said, but there is still a kind of Jewish exceptionalism at the heart of the movie. That's first of all certainly not met with any kind of Palestinian exceptionalism. Like we barely get to know it. You know, it's not whatever. It's not a movie about Palestinians.
Right? Yeah. Sure.
But like we get to meet Ali for those, you know, 3 or 4 minutes in that scene. Then they come back into the room. They fight over, you know, who gets to play the radio. Al Green comes on. Everybody's happy, you know, as is in real life. That would have, you know, as an Al Green person, I'll say that rang really true to me. But we still like the heart of the movie is what Eric said, that there's a kind of American exceptionalism at play. Right. Which is counterposed to Israel, which is pretty brave of Spielberg. But I want to say it draws on an older tradition of seeing America as exceptionalist because in some ways it mirrors narratives of Jewish history, right? And when I was watching the movie this time, I was thinking about this memoir that this Jewish American writer, Mary Anton, published early in the 20th century, I think 1911 or 12 or so. And her memoir about her life in the United States was called The Promised Land, right? And nobody was surprised, would have been surprised by that kind of rhetoric. It runs deep in all kinds of American narratives, right? That Americans are, if not literally like the lost tribe, somehow, you know, metaphorically, the fulfillment of the ancient Israelites who are wandering and looking for, right? And so that's where the movie drives me a little nuts, Because there's still, and that's the Robert speech, you know, the toy maker in the train station, right, where he goes on, and it's a beauty, and I fall for it every time I watch the movie, and then I'm filled with self-loathing for falling for it, because he gives this whole speech about Jews as if Jews are one legible, coherent, philosophically unified, you know, religious, cultural, historical body, right? You know, Avner, we're not supposed to, you know, he basically says, like, you know, thousands of years of suffering, like, don't make you good, but they're supposed to make you righteous, right? And that's a narrative that's been operationalized, obviously, incredibly violently by the state of Israel, but that is really a complicating rhetorical factor in United States history. You know, and by complicating, I mean bad. You know, like, it's like this idea that there's like a kind of mission-driven, positive frame to state building, right, which ignores what we've now learned to call settler colonialism, right, and, you know, histories of enslavement and erasure. Yeah, so that,
I mean, even to go back to the Golda Meir speech, there's you know, it's who gets to be the civilization that's, you know, deliberating like which compromises are, you know, acceptable, versus who is the kind of, who's the enemy of civilization, like against whom those compromises are going to be made. I think that it never, there are moments in the film where it seems to kind of, you know, try to subvert that. But I think that ultimately to me, the dominant note in the film is one of saying, you know, we are civilization, and that's why we need to, you know, be sure to live up to, you know, the values that we're supposed to embody. And that's, you know, that I think is just right. You know, however noble, you know, that message, the intent behind that message is, you know, often in practice, it's convenient for excuse making.
I want to ask you guys this, because this has obviously been looming over the conversation that we've had tonight, and frankly within our lives for the last few months now, which is, you know, what's going on in Palestine between Israel and the Palestinian people, Hamas. I don't even know how to frame this correctly. But how do we now reckon with this film and the events of what happened in Munich in 1972 following the attack by Hamas on Israeli people? And then the Israeli counteroffensive, the response, the onto not just Hamas but the Palestinian people writ large. How do we understand this movie? How do our understandings of this film change, of the situations in 72 change, and then frankly, how do we understand this situation now as a response in terms of what happened to Munich in 72? What the fuck do I think about anything anymore is really maybe the question that I've got.
Well, it's a tough and important question. I mean, I think, you know, to piggyback on what we were just saying, in some ways, I think that this movie now looks incredibly prescient in a lot of ways. I think we've really seen where, you know, my friend, the historian Gabe Winant, wrote a piece a few weeks after October 7th, where he argued in the opening lines that Israel is a machine for turning grief into power. And I think that this, in some ways, that really is the conclusion of this film. And it makes it very powerfully, that sort of the, you know, the way that grief gets weaponized, the sort of boundlessness of what it's taken to license, the selectivity, you know, who gets to grieve and seek revenge. I think those are all films or themes that the film explores very well. I think that, you know, one thing, the events since October 7th have really underscored is it, to my mind, again, the kind of problematic way that, you know, Israel and America get played off against each other as foils. You know, to circle way back to earlier in the conversation, you know, one one feature of 1972 is that, you know, the U.S. and Israel are really not very closely entwined at this time in history anywhere near the extent that that they are today. I mean, you know, the U.S. is definitely a backer of Israel. You know, it sees it as a bulwark against Soviet influence in the Middle East, you know, which is aligned with Arab nationalism. But there's really an inflection point in 1973 where, again, with, you know, Kissinger and Nixon in the White House, there's this moment of, you know, okay, we can, Israel can be for us what South Vietnam failed to be for us. You know, this can really be not just a kind of strategic, you know, asset in the region, but a true kind of client state. And that sort of, you know, full-fledged client state relationship had not really solidified at the time that this film begins. And so, you know, you really don't see, again, I think that that's the kind of crucial historical backdrop that allows Spielberg to play off, you know, Israel and the U.S. in the way that he does at the end of the film. Whereas, again, I mean, for me, one of the key, you know, messages, lessons of the last few months is to see exactly how close the U.S. and Israel have been intertwined. You know, right now the idea of trying to, you know, critique Israel in the name of American values, that rings to me very hollow, because, you know, at least as I see it, there's a lot of a profound degree of American complicity, both materially in terms of, you know, sending weapons, aid, materiel, as well as, you know, moral, ideological in a lot of the crimes that we've seen the Israeli military commit. So I think that that's the one aspect that doesn't feel as prescient or as urgent to the moment.
Yeah, no, Eric, that's beautifully put. And I mean, 73, obviously, I'll also just throw in, was the moment of the, you know, OPEC oil embargo and, like, sort of clear U.S. needing a client state, you know, for a number of additional reasons that it hadn't had before. And as you were speaking, the thing, you know, to Jason's question that really came to me is how truly welcome this movie would be if it were made for me this year, and how impossible that seems. Like, I'm imagining, like, you know, Bill Ackman, you know, like, you know, sort of like revving up his plagiarism detector to try to take Spielberg down, you know, for daring to ask. Like, our moment, it's become so remarkably difficult to entertain complexity, even. I don't even want to say, you know, Eric said critique, just even that, like, things are complicated. You know, there was somebody who wrote, a former film critic for Entertainment Weekly, wrote a piece in the New York Times, I think late in the calendar year, late in 23, Lisa Schwartzbaum, you know, who basically said this about Munich. She said, this is the movie that we need right now to think about Israel and Gaza. And I didn't like it was a great premise. And I was glad, unbelievable that the New York Times published this, given what their pages have been like, you know, in general. You know, and Schwartzbaum, like, she did a sort of kind of classic liberal American Jewish thing. She was like, it's a really great movie because it reminds us that there's a lot of gray areas, you know? And that's, like, exactly what I don't want us to do with this movie. And I think Eric's been particularly strong on saying, like, it's not gray areas that the movie is showing, right? It's showing, like, bloody red zones, you know? It's showing, like, how, like, that, you know, this history is a history of brutal settler colonial violence, you know, very much underwritten by Western white imperialist powers, starting with Great Britain, but then obviously with the United States stepping into the role that Britain originally played. And in our own moment, to, like, have that kind of critique, like, you know, we've all, you know, whatever, I'm sure we've all seen the fights on social media where you get in trouble for calling Israel settler colonial when you're like, look, they say it. It's not me saying it. It's what their government is saying, right? Like, I'm just repeating, you know, what, you know, their foreign secretary said. So that's the thing about this movie that I mean, I would love to kind of follow Schwartzbaum's lead and just kind of get people to, like, look at this movie and say, wow, that kind of tips the apple cart, doesn't it? You know, like, it's not really clear who, you know, the good guys. I mean, that's, you know, back to your spy movie thing. It's also a Western, right? But it's a Western where we don't know who's wearing which hat, you know, like, and that's a really useful thing about the movie. And I think that gives it even more salience now, maybe than it had in 2005, which I think, as we've established, was plenty.
Yeah, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, Eric was talking about this being one of Spielberg's, you know, secretly brilliant films in a lot of ways, because God, it just complicates things. And if I can, you know, speak to a guy who really grew up really removed from these conversations my entire life. Western Kentucky is not a hotbed of discussions over the Middle East, unless you're talking about whether it's Christmas or Xmas, right? For me, my experience growing up was, sympathizing with Jewish people because the Holocaust, and we grow up in these things. And like, therefore, because these people were preyed upon, and you grew up reading the Bible, things like that, slavery in the Old Testament, things like that. Oh, I am to sympathize with the Jewish people. Okay, got it. Now, and I'm talking about this as a guy who grows up Southern Baptist, right? I am to sympathize with Jewish people. These things happen. Munich happens. Okay, I sympathize with Jewish people. And then I watch this film. And this dark aspect of the state complicates all of this. And now I also have to – now I look at what's going on in the Middle East, and I still don't understand how I am supposed to feel about this, because I want to support people. And I want to sympathize with people. And at the same time, I see state actions, and states are made of people. And I am just ripped up inside because I don't know how to feel anymore. And it's all I can think is, oh my God, can we not murder? Would that be a nice change of pace? I don't, you know, this movie complicates all of those things. And I think that's a testament to the film, right?
Yeah, no, I think, Jason, you're supposed to have night sweats. I mean, that's like that's what I feel like at the end of the movie. You're supposed to be like Avner. You're supposed to be sitting upright in bed losing your shit because, like, these state-sponsored narratives don't leave room for people to have families. And to, right, like, that's what's so brutal for Avner at the end is he can't – when we see that clip of him, you know, Daphne runs to him and then he catches sight of his baby, right? And she just looks like, I mean, I don't know how much you guys have seen these kind of like Portage photos of Jewish immigrants, you know, turn of the 20th century. She is she is just a gorgeous off the boat Eastern European Jewish baby. Like, you know, it looks wise, like his little baby, and he can't protect her, right? Like you're supposed to feel, you know, if you are a parent, if you imagine that, you know, what it's like to be a parent, like you're supposed to feel the ultimate terror there. Like you can't protect your own kid.
Well, and I'd say even more than that. I mean, the whole ending bit. I mean, the tragedy is that this, you know, this Jewish family comes to the conclusion that they actually cannot be safe in Israel. You know, they are not safe in this state that's, you know, supposed to promise them safety, not because of the threat of Arab or Palestinian violence, but because of their own state's violence. And so to me, I think that really does work to, you know, try to drive a wedge between this question of Jewish personhood, Jewish safety, and, you know, the power of the state of Israel, where you see these two, you know, actually opposed, which is what drives Avner away.
That's it. I mean, you said it, Jason. States are bad. You know, like, I think if there's any real moral of the movie, like, states are bad. Like, it's not, you know, states are not healthy.
I mean,
for children.
You've got a state saying, let's relocate an entire people from their homeland. And I'm like, Jesus Christ. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
Everything breaks my heart. And I feel powerless to change anything. And I watch these films and it just exposes my own ignorance. You know, I don't know. So, all right, let me ask you guys this, what is probably the easiest question in the history of this podcast, which is Munich a history film? Mm.
Well, I mean, you know, self-evidently in a lot of ways, but I do think there are layers. I mean, as we said, and as this really sort of on the nose final shot of the Twin Towers illustrates, it's it's also a film of its own time, which is now also history for us. Right. So it's a film about history that's also about its own present, which is now about a different, you know, epic
of
history for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kamala Harris, just the other day, she was talking about, she was like, Gen Z, man, you know, if you're 18 years old today, you were born in 2005. Yeah, that's this film.
No, it's a real marker, isn't it? And it's you know, Eric gave a beautifully complex answer. I'll give a much simpler answer, is that I think in 2005, lots of us thought of it as a history film, but in the sense that, you know, Foucault talked about the histories of the present, right? Like it was so much like a film that was using history to try to tell us something about where we were. And you said it, Jason, in 03, 04, right? Like when the film was being made, that's always a great question to ask, is not what year did a film come out, but what do we imagine was the 2-3 year buildup? And this is such an Iraq war movie, right? Which audiences may or may not feel now, but we sure felt it then, right? And I think a lot of people who wrote about it certainly got that's what Spielberg was up to. So now then, to kind of fold it into your other question, what do we do with the movie now? Like, what, you know, we're historians at the movies, you know, what do we do with this movie? And we say, like, okay, could we somehow bring it into a classroom to teach students about what that Iraq war moment felt like and post 9/11 felt like? Well, I certainly would never use it to teach students anything about 1972, right? There's not enough in the movie for that, right? This wouldn't be where you'd go to learn about the Munich Olympics or about Middle East crisis of 72, 73. You know, Eric pointed us to the Yom Kippur. Like, the movie's not giving us a lot there, right? I might use it in a history of Jewish American culture class because it does bring together so many themes that have been, you know, important throughout 20th century, you know, for Jews in the United States. But it's a really, if it's a history movie, it's a really fucked up history movie, in a good way. Like, you know, that makes us ask, what do we want movies to do for us, you know, in terms of telling history anyway? Yeah. Yeah. Great question. Yeah.
Some of us only like fucked up history.
That's it.
Listen, this is like the 70th pod we've recorded. This is one of them, right? And but these are the films. This is the reason why I feel like we've got to continue to do this, because the art and the history collide in ways that inform us about the past. And frankly, more, I mean, like you're just saying, Jeff, this movie is far more about 2004, 2005 than it is about 1972. Right. I mean, this is, and now we can use this as this vehicle to think about 2024.
And I mean, thank you guys, because I'm literally about to start a grad seminar in study of popular culture next week. And one of the things, like, I need to always remind myself to bring to students is that, like, popular culture texts are like about things, but they're also of things, right? Like, they're of their moment of creation and reception and like that. To me, like that, you know, and I'll go back to Armin White again. I really appreciate the guy because he really helped me see in that moment that Spielberg was litigating that moment, you know, and not that many people were having that conversation about Steven Spielberg in 2002 when Minority Report came out, or 05, as Eric said, when these other two movies came out. And that's just really important work for us to do as, you know, historians, popular culture scholars, is to sort of say, like, what are the kind of symptoms of the culture that help us read the culture? And that's incredibly useful.
Guys, in our moment in time now, where do people find you guys on social media? I'm trying to find a segue. Where do people find you on social media? Where do they find you online? Where do people find out more about your scholarship and your work?
On the website formerly known as Twitter, I'm at Eric M. Baker. I'm also at ericmbaker.com for more of my writing and speaking.
Eric, will you say when your book's coming out and who's putting it out so we can all keep our eye on that? Because I've read pieces that I think are drawn from, and it's going to be a big deal.
Thanks. It's called "Make Your Own Job: The Entrepreneurial Work Ethic in Modern America." It's coming out fall of this year, 2024, with Harvard University Press.
I am also on the formerly known as Twitter machine. I'm just Melnick Jeffrey One. Currently defending my daughter's honor from right wing trolls. Not that she needs defending. She's a tough broad. So I'm there. I used to be there mostly for music stuff and fun conversations. And, you know, recently it's been much more of an important political space for me. I've written some books in the past. I'm currently working on a book on Boston's music scenes from the 1970s through the 90s, fairly early writing stages, but that I hope will be out in the next couple of years, and it's under contract with University of North Carolina Press.
All right, dudes, thank you so much.
Terrific. Thanks, guys.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so very much to our guests, Jeff Melnick and Eric Baker. Guys, thank you so much for being here, for taking on this topic today, for helping us to understand the world around us. And thank you, of course, to our producer, Fletcher Powell, for making all of this possible. And most of all, thank you to you guys for your continued support for the HATM podcast. You know, the big changes are coming, which I'll be sharing with you soon. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you for continuing to share this pod with your friends, for supporting this on the Substack. You can find that at jasonherbert.substack, and leaving reviews on Apple, Spotify, and everything else. So a couple last little things. This week, we've got Field of Dreams coming up on the Sunday night watch party. So if you're around and you want to watch movies with your friends, you can do that 8 p.m. Eastern. It is available on Amazon Prime. We'll see you guys on Twitter. We'll talk to you a little bit later. Ciao for now.